and welcome to Motorpod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 583 for Wednesday, the 31st of October 2018. My name is Andrew Kors here in Switzerland, and this week we have a global team effort, as this is going to be a two-part show. Myself and Mr. Len Padilla will be starting off with a review of the final round of the World Superbike Championship from the deserts of Qatar. And then we'll hand over to Jim and Derek in the US as they discuss the insane MotoGP racing that we had this weekend from Phillip Island in Australia. Len, how you doing, sir?
I'm doing pretty well. Happy Halloween, Andrew.
Oh, yeah, thanks. It's a bit cold and drafty. I'm not sure if we're going to have any little ones out on the Wednesday. We'll see how we go. How about your neighborhood?
Yeah, well, here it happens on November 1st. It's the same sort of thing, but there's a little less dressing up, but the same thing. You know, kids going house to house, asking for sweets. But it was snowing in 2 degrees all day here, so I don't know if we're going to get any kids on Thursday. We'll see.
Yeah, it's a shame. I love living in Canada, who, like most North America, went for Halloween pretty wholesale. It was always good fun wandering around the neighborhood, seeing all the houses made up and all the kids in costume and stuff. We don't get to get that quite so much here in Switzerland.
Yeah. Here the same. Here they get straight down to the business. Just give me some candy.
And I assume you got to catch up a little bit on some of the racing from the MotoGP in Phillip Island.
I did. Yeah. Watched my favorite kind of racing, which is early morning before the day starts. So yeah, watched Phillip Island, which was fantastic. And what racing there was from Qatar, I saw that as well.
Yeah, I think we had three really good races from Moto3, Moto2, and MotoGP. So do stick around to listen to Jim and Derek discuss that. We're going to be fairly brief, I think, with the World Superbikes because we know there is so much to talk about from MotoGP. And World Superbikes, in fact, were kind enough to help us out by not bothering to put on a race too. But given the weather out there, hardly surprising.
Yeah, it's pretty strange. I mean, it can happen, I suppose. You know, they do get storms. But yeah, I was really disappointed. I'd come back after doing I don't know what during the day and sat down to watch it recorded, and bang, all of a sudden, no race. Yeah, what a shame.
I don't know if you saw some of the scenes, but it was pretty fierce weather. I mean, certain elements of the track got damaged as well. I even heard like there was a great big TV satellite dish that got ripped from its mountains and went flying off across the paddock, as well as some hoardings that came down. I think some of the lamp stands that got bent over. So it was pretty full on.
Wow, sounds pretty bad. Sounds like Martin picked a good time to split town.
Well, there you go. There's a conspiracy theory. You know, instead of being there, he was sunning himself in the south of France.
Yeah, flying air-conditioned helicopters, we must add.
I know, air conditioning, what next? These things will have flipping, like, built-in wine bars in them, honestly. I know, these guys don't know they're born. Okay, but before we get into the meat and potatoes, I just want to take a minute to thank some fellow listeners who were kind enough to throw some bucks in the hat this week. Keith Kovac, thank you, sir. Alan Fleming, you are a star. We had a Patreon, Lester NG, no less. Lester, I salute you. And James Pretorio, next time Len sees you, he owes you a drink. Thank you very kindly.
Definitely, I'm buying.
We did have a little bit of World Superbike news before they got started in Qatar. It wasn't necessarily a big official fanfare, but it pretty much came out in most of the racing press. It was discussed over the weekend. Sean Muir Racing seems to have signed Tom Sykes and the European Superstock Championship winner Marcus Reiterberger, who won on an S1000RR. And those riders will be fronting a new BMW-backed squad for the 2019 World Championship. It seems like BMW have got a new head. I don't know if he's a new head of Motorrad or if he's just a new head of BMW Motorsport. But I think it is a new head of Motorrad. And unlike his predecessor, he does seem to believe that there is some value in taking his bikes racing. And with the upcoming launch of a new BMW S1000RR at EICMA, it looks like that Sean Muir Racing will be the official factory-backed BMW squad for 2019. And that explains probably why they went with the German Marcus Reiterberger, who won the championship this year on an S1000RR, and Tom Sykes being the other rider. Now, the person who then got the boot, unfortunately, was Eugene Laverty. And I'm not 100% sure if Tom Sykes is really any better than Eugene. What do you think?
Well, at qualifying, definitely. I mean, he's definitely Mr. Super Pole, and he has, you know, won a world championship, so he knows what it takes to do that. But that was, what, 5-6 years ago. Today, God, today on the same machinery, I think I would have to put my money on Eugene. He seems to have a little more left at the end of races, whereas Tom sometimes starts fairly well and then spends the race just sort of sliding to the back.
The only thought I had that may have given Tom the sort of nod is, I know if he has this reputation of it, was him who did the majority of the development work for the ZX-10 that turned it into such a weapon.
Right, that could be. They could be looking at him for that, and they'll definitely need that because, you know, it's one thing to have a fantastic new street bike, but turning that into a race bike is a completely different kettle of fish.
Yeah, and they'll have no data for that bike at all. So they'll definitely need some direction from their riders. So good combination. Nice to see a new manufacturer back. Unfortunately, although we do gain BMW, it seems by the same token, we've lost Aprilia. It doesn't sound like they will be lining up. Certainly nowhere any kind of factory effort. It sounds like all their focus is going on to MotoGP.
Right. I mean, it's a shame. It's a shame to have them, you know, to not have them in the World Superbike paddock anymore. But realistically, I think they were stretched too thin. I don't think they really have the resources, the budget, the sponsorship, whatever it takes to run, you know, a top level effort in both paddocks. I mean, it shows because right now they're just not doing it.
Well, and this is I think this is Sean's kind of bugbear is that he was having to pay essentially for Aprilia to do the development on their bike, and it was like they were only prepared to do what he was prepared to pay for. So, you know, he felt he wanted more factory involvement, more factory help, and he wasn't get that. Unfortunately, you know, for me as an Aprilia owner, it's kind of sad to see there not being a road bike running in the Superbike Championship. But I know, them's the breaks, and let's see if that does give them a bump in performance next year in MotoGP.
Let's hope so.
So the other rumour, almost certainly confirmed, is Leon Camier has seems to have been re-signed or kept for Honda for 2019. And the other good news is it sounds like there will be more factory involvement, a bit more of a factory effort from Honda helping them out next year. The second ride is yet to be confirmed, but with that additional extra factory support, there's been some rumors that it could be a Japanese rider that will be lining up alongside Leon for next year.
Interesting. Well, I hope that means that Honda are taking it seriously. They don't seem to have been doing that for several years now.
Yeah, their focus, I think, at this level is probably just Suzuka, but I'm hoping that they recognize and feel that they're, you know, they should, you know, they have more than enough engineering prowess, people, and capability to run their MotoGP effort. I mean, in comparison, this is like small potatoes, and I would hope that you know, they could get some people and some of their engineers involved, and yeah, have a boost in performance. So that could be another manufacturer upping their game and bringing some more competitive machinery for next year.
Yeah, well, like you said, if they decide to take it seriously, I can't wait to see it.
Unfortunately, it does sound like MV will not be taking part next year. Sounds like their team will be withdrawn. We know that MV's sort of shifted, I guess, their PR focus to run in Moto2, and it sounds like that's going to be their promotional focus, I think, for next year. This was the last year, I believe, of the F4, so I don't know if we'll see in maybe 1 or 2 years a new superbike developed, and they might be back. Who knows?
I think they've got a long way to come back. I mean, they've spent a long time sort of halfway doing it, but we'll see. If they can get the money and build a new bike, it would be nice to see.
Now, I know you are a past Ducati owner. I'm sure you shed a tear recognizing that this was going to be the last race of the traditional Ducati V-twin in its form of the Panigale.
I classify myself like people who don't practice a religion. I'm a reformed Ducati owner.
I've seen the lights.
I will admit that having owned two Ducatis and ridden them extensively on the track cured me of any feelings of goodwill towards the Ducati factory.
Well, it's quite a lineage. I mean, I know really it was like the 1199, which is probably named the Panigale, but I think, you know, it can trace its lineage, its roots to its great-great-great-great-great-grandfather, which is probably the 851, which I think Raymond Roche, the French rider, took a championship on in 1990. So, I mean, we've had the 851, the 888, the 916, the 996, the 998, the 999. the 1098, the 1198, the 1199 Panigale are. Yeah, so I guess they probably just, there was nowhere else to go but a V4.
Yeah, but all joking aside, I mean, it is, well, not a shame because things move on, but you're right. It is definitely sort of the end of an era. That bike has been there for a long time. They've, maybe the rules favored them a little bit in the early days. Maybe that's why they did so well, but you know, whatever, that it was what it was. They won lots of races, won lots of championships, beautiful bikes always to look at. And you were saying that when you look at them, you can trace the lineage all the way back. A tip, if you haven't ever done it, if you take the fairings off of a Ducati, something before a Panigale, obviously, one of the trellis-framed bikes, if you take the fairings off, I think you can trace the lineage back to early 20th century tractors. They look like a farm implement without the fairings on. They're pretty rough and ready.
Oh, the hate mail we're going to get from Ducati owners is
surreal. That's all right. That's all right.
So that's len@motorpodcast.com.
Bring it on.
I think the main talking point coming out of the World Superbike, though, was, okay, so fine, we had Tom Sykes with the seat marker, so I could write a burger, moving up. But there was a lot of riders into this last race with no confirmed rides for next year, which is amazing because you're thinking like, well, November, I think they start testing again.
Yeah, it is all very quiet. And it makes me wonder if that's more, you know, on the business side of racing. You know, if the teams don't have sponsors, they're waiting to see what riders bring. You know, it could be just down to that, waiting to see what different riders can bring as far as personal sponsorship to the teams to round out the budget.
Yeah, the only thing I could thought was maybe there's still, you know how often you have one or two key riders that everyone else is sort of waiting on, and then once their future, once they drop into a seat, then everything else falls a little bit like dominoes. But yeah, we'll have to see. I don't know if there'll be a few more announcements at the upcoming bike show EICMA in Milan, which I think is about 2 weeks' time in November. Well, this was going to be the last two races of this year, and going in to this round, essentially, obviously top spot, signed, sealed, delivered. Johnny Ray has got that done, but there was still some bonus money on the line for second place. Chaz Davis currently sat in a second in the championship. Some 24 points behind is Michael Vandermark. So realistically, I think those are the two people we were watching for the races to fight out positions, you know, second and third in the championship. And like I say, as we came into Super Pole 1, it was unusual to see that the track conditions were tricky in some places. I mean, they'd had this massive rainfall. I think they said something like the heaviest for 4 years. I'm waiting for Martin to jump in and correct me. I mean, he would know, but certainly an unusual amount of rain. Qatar just really doesn't sound like it's designed for regular rainfall. There doesn't sound like there's much in the way of drainage. It rarely, if ever, happens. And with that amount of rain, it sounded like it left some really, really huge puddles in places, and definitely flooding in other parts as well. Super Pole 1 was a bit of a bizarre event to watch because ultimately we only had 7 riders in the Super Pole 1. I mean, the Triple M team didn't come to the event. People like Michael Rudin and Rinaldi were only running in the European rounds anyway. So it was quite a slow, spectacle to watch, just only 7 bikes on track.
It was our opportunity, Andrew. We should have been there.
Oh, you know what? You're right. You're right. I might not have made it into Super Pole 2, but I could have qualified on the grid. I wonder if they have the 107% rule.
I certainly hope they do. That might have ruled us out.
Yeah. It was Leon Camier who did take the top spot in the Super Pole 1, and Javier Forrest on the Ducati. They both went through into Super Pole 2. Super Pole 2, a little bit more action. We had 12 riders out on track, and Laverty taking like an early lead in the Super Pole 2. He'd been fast through most of the free practices, as had Alex Lowes. The Aprilia just seemed to have some horsepower that really suited the track. I don't know, with their gearing set, we always have these instances where The gearing that they've picked for beginning of the year just works for certain tracks better than it does at other ones. But here, it was clearly Aprilia's had a speed advantage down the back straight. But Lowe's was going well too, and he took top spot in the sort of the first of the two runs that they do during Super Pole.
Yeah, it was good to see Alex. He was doing really well. He's had it sort of an up and down year. He's been there at some points. He's fallen off a lot. But yeah, he did manage to put together a pretty decent qualifying run, and we'll talk about how he ended up finishing a little bit later.
Yeah, and then for the second run, Laverty was one of the first riders out, and we watched everyone else exit the pits. And it was interesting to see that Melandri was really left it quite late, such that, you know, it was clear that he was only going to have the opportunity for one flying lap, so he was right at the back. But unfortunately, he was so late out of the pits that by the time Laverty came around on his flying lap, he ended up catching Melandri on his outlap, and he just seemed to be dozing or sleeping on the racing line. And Laverty definitely lost a little bit of time. I'm not sure if it was enough time ultimately to lose pole, but it was pretty close because only Laverty and Lowe's really got a chance of a second lap. But as the clock ticked to zero, it was Johnny Ray who went top, but only briefly because Mr. Poleman himself, Tom Sykes, takes pole, and he took it with a new pole record of a 156.124, which was really, really impressive and a huge time gap. If you look at the finishing order, I mean, you look down the top 10, I think Kamiya, who ultimately finished that qualifying in 10th, I mean, he was down like a 157.682. So, you know, it's a good second and a half over those top 10 places. So when I saw that, I was thinking like, oh, this doesn't bode necessarily well for the race.
No, that definitely looks like a race that's going to be pretty spread out. And I think that's one of the most spread qualifying sessions we've had this year. I mean, like you said, a second and a half covering the top 10 is, well, it's not what we're used to seeing these days.
No, and unfortunately, for whatever reason, the Ducatis really didn't seem to go well in the qualifying. I mean, we had Chaz Davis, he was down in 12th, and Marco Melandri down in 9th as well. So, you know, Vandermark as well, who's only in 8th as well. So, you know, I think that for me already was kind of where the race was going to be between Chaz potentially and Vandermark.
Yeah, and there was a bit of that as we'll talk about later. It did get kind of spicy down in the middle, but certainly not where those guys really should be qualifying. I mean, Chaz, maybe he's still a little bit hurt, but you know, we've seen some real fire from Marco this year and from Michael as well. I would expect to see them up just a little bit further.
Yeah, I think for me, you know, when I look at the times and you see that you know, Marco's like a 157.4, Chaz is a 157.8. To my mind, that just seemed to say that was kind of basically the pace. I mean, the top Ducati, Javier Forest, again, how many times has he beaten the factory Ducatis in qualifying? 157.2, so he's only 0.2 ahead of Melandri. So definitely, I think the Ducatis are going to struggle over the length of the race. So race one was under the floodlights, which is always great to see. I mean, it's such a completely different visual dynamic when you see racing under the floodlights. I love seeing the clear visors. I mean, unfortunately, the stands are a little empty, so the cameramen had to keep the angles pretty tight. You could sort of sense there was no real, you know, crowd atmosphere, unfortunately.
Yeah. The nighttime racing is pretty super cool. It reminds me of some of the first racing I saw when I was a kid, which was speedway racing, which was always super exciting, you know, seeing it at night, seeing fire popping out of the pipes and all of that. And it's, it's what got me first into bike racing, and it's cool to see it here as well.
Yeah. So race one, Johnny Ray is sat in second place on the grid, and essentially he's off to just get more records. I think he was after Doug Poland's record of 17 wins in the season. I think he'd already equaled it, but he wanted to beat it. No, that's right. If he won this, he'd equal it, because he was a 16 wins in one season up at this point, and then hopefully in race two, he'd go on, if he could, to eclipse it. And equally, as we said, there's probably a lot of people looking for some good results to put them in the shop window for 2019 as well.
Yeah, it did seem like not everybody was running up front with Johnny Ray, obviously, but everybody, wherever they were, seemed to be trying pretty hard. You know, there was a good scrap going on between Alex and Eugene. There was a good scrap further back with some of the riders in 6th, 7th, 8th. So there was a lot of good racing happening, even if it wasn't all up front.
Yeah, and it was, I mean, essentially it was Johnny Ray who just, you know, took the lead, you know, straight past Sykes early on and just started to stretch his lead. Sykes hung in there for second, but he had a pretty lonely race there in second, just trying to, you know, keep the gap. He was there for a while, but he just didn't seem to quite have the pace and just gently drifted back as Johnny took away. But yeah, the real action, and it was some good action, some good, really close racing and some pretty aggressive passes between Eugene Laverty and Alex Lowes on the Yamaha.
Yeah, there definitely was. I mean, they both put it under. It was fair passing. It was, but it was very, very tough. There were some pretty aggressive moves, some lunges from, you know, not terribly far back, but enough to surprise the other rider a little bit. So it was, all good, hard, fair racing. It was good to see.
And it was Lowe's, unfortunately, who was having to do all the hard work, because he'd do all the hard work in the twisty bits, and then Laverty would just use that probably a speed advantage and often
and just walk
of,
past
yeah,
him.
Yeah, he'd get him back. So Alex was really having to push hard to get him early on in the lap to try and pull a bit of a gap. And ultimately, as we got towards the end, I think, you know, Alex was able to get past and then stay in front. And I think Laverty was struggling definitely with the front tire. And I think it was literally the, you know, it was still cut and thrust almost on the last lap, but you could see Laverty was really starting to struggle with that front tire. And I think literally on the last lap, on the last corner, you saw Laverty, you know, trying to get back past Lowe's, almost tucked the front, almost lost the bike completely because that tire had just gone. And that really did, you know, give Alex the third place on the podium with Eugene in fourth place. There've been some good scraps a little bit further behind. Melandri had been able to work his way up into fifth, and Baz came good as well in sixth after starting from back of a distance and then gradually catching up and then eclipsing and passing Michael Vandermark, in seventh, and Chaz Davis in eighth for Baz to take sixth. You know, that was some pretty good racing from him.
It was super good. I mean, like you said, he started in the back. He didn't make his move very early. Maybe he was just conserving tires, or maybe he just didn't have it in him. But when those guys came back to him, he really came to life. It was almost as if that was the motivation that he needed, and he started just picking them off one at a time. And he was, well, I was going to say riding like we haven't seen in a while. The bad thing is, even with a good rider like Loris Baz, you know, the camera isn't often on him. But, you know, this time it was, and he shone while it was. You know, he was really riding hard and really making a good show.
Yeah, it was good to watch. And again, unfortunately, Loris Baz, another ex-MotoGP rider, good rider, who doesn't have a confirmed seat as yet for next year. Some rumors to say that he might be off to Tyco BMW in BSB for next year. But again, more rumors, we'll have to wait and see. So Johnny Ray, after taking the win, that did mean he equaled Doug Poland's record of 17 wins in a season. I think also that was something like 56 wins for the same manufacturer. So that means he took Foggy's record. So, I mean, what can you say? Just, you know, an impressive, dominant season, as we've already said, from Johnny Ray. And just, you know, this ultimately turned out to be the last race, because at this point we didn't know that race two wasn't going to happen. There was a little bit of controversy, I think I did see, though, just at the very last lap of that race one. I don't know if you saw underneath the gantry, there's like a sign that sort of counts down the laps, and it looked like on where it should have said last lap, it came up and said final lap.
Yeah, you know, I didn't see that during the race. I read something about it afterward. Was it Loris Baz that was somehow unhappy about it?
There was a couple of riders, I think. Forres, as well.
I think they
saw final lap, and as they crossed the line, they rolled off. And then someone somewhere recognized their mistake, and it flipped back to say last lap. And then, in fact, they still had another lap to go. It's unclear, you know, how that really impacted a lot of them, but
yeah, at the end of the day, it probably didn't change the result significantly. But I can imagine for those riders who are, you know, expecting to see what they're expecting to see, that's got to be pretty frustrating.
Yeah. So it was Chaz Davis that finished up second in the championship, Michael Vandermark in third, Tom Sykes in fourth, and Marco Melandri there in fifth. Like we say, race two unfortunately didn't happen. the Saturday, they really had some pretty terrible storms and some fairly heavy rain. And even though the Supersport race did run, and I really highly recommend if you have the ability to watch that on replay, whether it's Eurosport, whether it's through the Superbike Video Pass, please go watch the Supersport race, because it was pretty epic, I have to say, especially where there were large patches of water and some literally rivers streaming from one side of the track to the other due to the lack of drainage. So it was pretty hectic and entertaining racing.
Yeah, it was great. It was one of these races where it's all on the line. It's all about finishing first, you know, with a few other qualifiers. But, you know, you need to finish first to win the championship. Two scrappy riders, maybe one more scrappier than the other. I think Jules Cluzel is a terrier. I love watching him race. He's a trier. He never gives up. And he really lived up to that in this race. He needed to win, and he was all in every corner. It got away from him a little bit. He was coming back, but then it just all went wrong. But fantastic race. And like you're saying, anybody who's interested in some good racing from Qatar, I think the Supersport race was the race of the weekend.
Yeah, I agree about Cluzel. I mean, when you saw the conditions of the track where he had come around a corner and he'd be like full lean, and then there'd be this little stream of water across, and he'd quickly just get the bike up to try and, you know, stand it up as best he could, go splashing through the water and then straight back into the lean again to finish off the corners. I mean, equally too, I remember, I think on the main straight as well, they go through these huge, great big puddles, huge spray of water. You know, now you in your mind, you're thinking you've got slick tires, soaking wet, and this is just before you're about to hit the brakes for your braking marker at the end of that fast main straight. It was all in.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking about too, is that last, you would watch them, they'd go through that last bit of water and just right after that get on the brakes. And I was just thinking the whole time, man, you know, with the front tire being wet, going to the brakes on a long straight like that, hats off to those guys. And I don't think anybody threw it away really as a result of the water. So it was, you know, great racing.
Yeah. Fortunately, after that, it was the Superbike race that was due to be run, but race direction and the riders all got together and just said, you know, although technically we could run it, you know, someone will end up in hospital if we do. I think the reason they also ran the Supersport race is there was still a championship to decide. That wasn't the case with Superbike. So at the end of the day, you know, it just doesn't seem reasonable or much of a point to have actually raced it.
Well, they finished it pretty well. Like you said, it was a bit disappointing to lose the last race. But if I'm honest, it was kind of in character, in keeping with the season we've had for World Superbike. But yeah, hopefully we'll get some new bikes. Hopefully Honda takes it seriously. Hopefully BMW brings a good bike. And 2019 will be better.
Yeah, for sure. So really, that's the warm-up, because the main event is Jim and Derek talking about the Australian Motorcycle Grand Prix that we had at the weekend. Len, thank you very much for taking a little bit of time just to sit down, catch up, and talk World Superbikes.
You bet, Andrew. And I'm looking forward to sitting down and catching up and talking about bikes and riding bikes with you in just a few weeks.
Yes, in Jerez. Let's hope for some warm weather down there.
Fingers crossed.
Fantastic. Thanks, Len. Okay, like I say, next up is Jim and Derek with the MotoGP from Australia. Zoom, zoom.
Bye.
Hey, thanks, Len and Andy, for that World Superbike update. Now let's move on to the second half of the doubleheader weekend with MotoGP racing from Australia. And I can't do it alone, so with me to chat about the crazy racing from down under is Derek. Hey, Derek.
What's going on, Jim? Some really crazy racing from Australia this past weekend. So, happy to dive into it with you.
Yep. So let's get right to it. So we're just going to cover some quick MotoGP news and one bit of Moto America news that we have. So from the MotoGP news, Cal Crutchlow fractured his ankle in three places at a Turn 1 crash in free practice 2. That was a gnarly get-off going into Turn 1. He did have to have surgery on his ankle before he left from Australia. He's now back, I believe, in the UK, and he will miss the race in Malaysia, and he is questionable for Valencia. Therefore, factory HRC reserve rider Stefan Bradl will sub for him in Malaysia, and it's possible Bradl Bradle will be on the bike in Valencia as well. Next in the news is Arena, who is the crew chief for Nakagami in Moto2, is rumored to be Lorenzo's crew chief on the Factory Repsol Honda team for next year. Interesting, Nakagami's not had the greatest of results, but he is but his crew chief is definitely one to look at. He does seem to be doing quite well, making the bike work, and has a good working rapport with him. It's interesting that you know, he's another Spanish guy, and so he will be in tune with Lorenzo, and they'll be on the same language, so there won't be the language barrier that there is between the two now.
Yeah, I think that's probably a solid option. I mean, I assume HRC hired him directly for Nakagami, so he's within the Honda family, I can assume. I don't know much about him, but...
No, neither do I.
But, yeah, that's going to be... I'm just excited to see Lorenzo on the Honda, regardless of who's his crew chief, you know? But, yeah, the language barrier is always a good thing. But still, a good bit of information, because as Mark Marquez shows, like, having the right people, having the right crew around you is one of the most important things. So it's like, I don't know, you see Scott Redding, who bounces around from crew chief to team, and like, I just called Scott Redding out of the blue. But like, I mean, there's tons of riders like that who, because they don't have consistency, I think can hurt them, even though they're a better rider than their results show. So, but yeah, it's, I'm just ready to see Lorenzo on the Honda.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's sort of like when when he left Honda, he took Burgess and company with him to Yamaha, right? And then when he left Yamaha, he took Burgess and crew to Ducati, and then he came back to Yamaha with them, and then finally, you know, he told Burgess to take a hike, because I guess their relationship had gotten stale. But I do think that there is that consistency thing. These are the people that kind of got you there, you know. They're the date you brought to the dance, you might as well just stick it out.
For sure. And I think Mark's taken that to the next level with like everyone around him kind of being brought up with him through 125s and Moto2 and now MotoGP, and they're basically his family, you know. He's really taken that to the next level. But yeah, your crew chief, rider, relationship, super important. I'm sure Lorenzo has had to okay that in some respect, but yeah. Anyway, moving on. Honda will overhaul their Moto 3 bike in an effort to one up KTM. There's always a little bit of a battle in between the Moto 3 manufacturers, and now with just two of them, it's always a pretty fierce competition.
Yep, I think Honda's had enough of KTM running away from their bikes in a straight line. Honda has never been ones to not have the most powerful or fastest machines in racing. And if Honda ever gets lost from the idea of having a rider perspective as far as input, and they are confused, they just go over and pray at the altar of speed and come up with a bike that's absolutely a blinding rocket ship in a straight line, which is surprising that they haven't built a MotoGP bike that is quicker in a straight line than the Ducatis. But that remains to be seen. Maybe they change it next year, but maybe it's all about rider friendliness, and that maybe is what makes you go faster. So be interesting to see what they do with their Moto 3 bike. They're definitely going to have to work on their acceleration, and they definitely have to work on their top end speed, because KTM has, ever since where were we?
I think it was Austria.
No, they came out Le Mans. They came out with the new airbox and the new exhaust, and they were just putting distance on Martin like there was no tomorrow. So. But I guess it's their turn, because last year KTM upped their game this year, so I guess Honda has to up their game for next year, and then KTM will go the next year. So there we have there. So the Moto2 race from Japan, we know that Quartararo was DQ'd for having a tire pressure on the rear that was lower than what is recommended by Dunlop. Now, this is all being investigated by the FIM. It was the reason that he was disqualified was based on the fact that this type of infraction, i.e. having a tire pressure outside of the specification limits of Dunlap, is a zero tolerance policy. In other words, if you're out of spec, whether it's by a tenth of a pound or a whole pound, it doesn't matter. You're disqualified. That's just how it works. Now, there's something going on here because, as you said, Derek, they have the data for the bike. They have a data logging system that actually reads the tire pressure on the bike. And the manufacturer of that equipment says, hey, there's a tolerance value of plus minus. Now, they won't say how big of a tolerance it is, but they're saying that it just has a tolerance of plus minus. The team has said that, hey, looking at all the data, we are within the realm of the variance of the tolerance that the manufacturer says is in their device. So therefore, we should be legal to the rules because we're within that zone of tolerance that everybody gets to play with, essentially. So stay tuned on this one. I don't think we've heard the last of this one. It could get a little bit muddy here, but who knows what's going to happen.
Yeah, I thought that was a super interesting pickup that Simon Crafar had from Pit Lane.
Mm-hmm.
Getting that, I think it was directly from Quartararo's crew chief, or was it from...
Oh, it was the guy who owns a team.
They also spoke directly to Dunlop, too. Just understanding that a little bit more. I mean, you and I touched on it last time, but to understand that the clarification of Dunlop's side and the team side, but I think when he was talking to Dunlop, the fact that they never, during the entire race from start to finish, never went over the minimum. They never got over that peak.
Correct.
I think, I mean, even if it is within a tolerance, like that, you should be, if you know that there's a tolerance and you know that there's a zero tolerance minimum, you got to be above that, just even on the line, you know? Like, you can't.
I completely agree with you.
So we might hear more about this, but I think the rules and the data seem pretty clear, but we'll see. I mean, Quartararo is going to MotoGP. I think, you know, there's two races left. He's not in the championship fight. I can see the team fighting it because the team wants to win, but I don't think it's going to be that big of a deal. But super interesting, and I'm glad that they were able to clarify it as much as possible, mm-hmm. even though they're not getting into the details. But really, really, really good insights.
Yep. The only precedent that we have to work from in recent times was when it was actually Agatar won at Misano a couple of years ago, and they found that the specification on the oil was outside of the viscosity range or specific gravity range. I don't remember which, but I do remember it was brought back up that it was Agatar who was disqualified. They appealed that and lost, so I have to believe that this is the same thing. They can appeal it on Quartararo's behalf, but they will probably lose that as well. Moving on to the last bit of news for MotoGP. This comes from the category of worst kept secrets. Danny Pedrosa has signed a 2-year deal to test the KTM MotoGP bike. I did not see any details for his contract as to whether or not he will get any wild cards or not. I'd like to see Danny have a wild card here and there on the KTM just to see what kind of progress they're actually making on it. But
yeah, I think Pit Byer said that there'll be 0 to 1 wild cards per year for the test rider role.
Hmm.
Because with Callio, they realized that the test team was... they were just trying to hurry up and set up for the next race meeting, and it became like a race test instead of a development test.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's probably what Danny wants too. Like, you know, like he still wants to ride the bike, but he doesn't want to deal with the whole weekend and the media and everything. I mean,
the Casey Stoner saga. The Casey,
yeah, I mean, not Casey Stoner, not at the level of Stoner, but
right.
But I think, you know, he just wants to go fast, you know. He's Ricky Bobby, you know. Like he still wants that rush and sensation of speed, but like, does he need to compete? Does he have anything more to prove? Like, he's one of the most winning riders of MotoGP, 3 world titles. Like, yeah, it'd be cool if he did a wild card. It's always cool to see. I'd love to see Danny in other colors, but you know, I don't necessarily think it's going to happen. I think KTM are much more focused on just developing parts. So. I think it's a really smart move for KTM. I'm actually quite surprised Danny didn't stick with Honda.
Mm-hmm. But that is a shocker for me.
But you can always, you know, these riders, these manufacturers, like, you can always go back and be an ambassador for that other brand, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, his history with Honda is not going away. Mm-hmm. So I think even if it's just temporary, it's still going to be a good thing for both Pedrosa and KTM.
Mm-hmm. So two things I got to say. One, how different is the orange and navy of Red Bull and KTM different than Repsol's navy and orange color?
I don't know. That Repsol's pretty bright, man.
And so that's one. Two, I think this is the first time that we can honestly say KTM will have a top flight MotoGP rider on their equipment. Not to disparage the other guys that are riding KTM, but none of them really had the pedigree of Pedrosa or sure. the knowledge and inner workings of a team such as Honda. So again, you know, Danny knows what a no lift shift gearbox should feel like, and you know, KTM I'm sure is working on one or has some variant thereof, and Danny's gonna hop on the bike and go, no, it doesn't shift right, it doesn't feel right, it doesn't, you know, do this or do that. And those could be the little things that they need to progress and come farther up the grid. So all I want to see is KTM fighting for podiums. I think that'd be totally cool because not that I don't love the racing that we have, but man, if you can throw Yamaha, Ducati, Honda, and a KTM in the mix, oof, that just makes things that much better.
What about Aprilia, Jim?
Got no love gosh, for Aprilia? Forget about Aprilia. Forget about Aprilia. Sorry. I knew I was going to leave somebody out in that hole. I forgot Suzuki too, right? So.
Oh, yeah. Well,
leaving everybody out. So the final bit of news is from Moto America. This comes from Superbike Planet, and they say that knowledgeable sources confirmed that the order period for the 2019 Ducati Panigale V4R Superbike has closed and that no orders from the U.S. were made in regards to race bikes or engines. So all of you Moto America fans and Ducati fans who wanted to see Ducati back in Moto America, that does not appear to be happening.
Yeah, that sucks.
I know you're in pain. I feel it.
We'll see. I mean, I feel like the Moto America stuff, it comes together so late. It's hard to believe that the period is closed already. I mean,
yeah,
I don't know about that. Like, I mean, I know the V4R is limited production numbers, but like, and even if you don't have factory support, I suppose it. A team could just buy a V4R, couldn't they? Right?
I would assume that's the essence of superbike racing is walking down I mean, you could.
I don't know. Look at what's Josh Aaron's team? Attack Performance.
The Kawas. Yamaha now it was. Yeah, Yamaha now. It used to be Kawas. I always remember him as Kawasaki, but yeah, Yamaha. Yeah. That is correct. Yes.
So what? I mean, they probably got an R. What do they use? The R1M, and they take that as a base and they do all the work in house. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, unless you're a BSB team, like a Paul Verne Motorsports, like getting factory Ducati backing. But like, I don't see why they couldn't just buy one off the showroom floor effectively. Even though there's going to be like 500 made or something. Those orders still have to be for consumers as well. And why can't a consumer be a small budget race team in America? Like, as much as it pains me to say it, the truth is, you know, American racing, you know, they're not large teams. They're really small family owned like dealerships in some cases. And, you know, that's they're like, you know, doing everything they can to put into this race bike, but they don't have a massive budget and they're not, you know, going to be getting it directly from Ducati Course. So. I don't know. Well, first of all, I don't know if I believe this fully. Second of all, even if it is true, I still think there's a possibility to see Ducati on the grid in Moto America next year.
It's Superbike Planet and Dean Adams, so you know. Take it with a grain of salt, people. But,
yeah. So we'll see. But why don't we talk about some some racing now.
Yes. So let's talk to MotoGP and specifically Moto3. So to refresh ourselves on the championship chase, we are basically looking at two horse race between Jorge Martin and Marco Bezzecchi. And after the events of Japan, in which Jorge Martin threw it down the road, basically it was a 1 point gap, 204 to 203. So then let's look at what transpired in qualifying for the little bikes. So qualifying was probably one of the best, if not the best, qualifying sessions we've seen so far out of the Moto3 guys. I think a lot of it had to do with the weather. It was cloudy. They had had a cloudburst that came across the track around lunchtime and had dissipated within 5 or 10 minutes. So there were maybe a damp patch here or there on the track, and the curbs were a little bit wet when this all started out. So consequently, we had sort of everybody rush out, and we had everybody trying to put down some really fast times that was there. So Ortel basically got out and first, and he wound up winding up with a very early pace. He went to the top. Suzuki came by and he had a fast lap. He was followed by Martin. He went to the top though. Well, then Binder went to the top, and well, Kornfeld was there. Then Binder went back on top again. So it was just back forth, back forth, back forth. Bezzecchi finally showed up and got there into the first place. Kornfeld became the fastest man. Ortel went back after he got a new tire on his second set of runs and became fastest. Basically, then the sun came out with about 17 minutes to go to add some extra warmth to the track, and Martin threw down a fast lap. After that, we had Martin basically come out in that last group to try to give it, like, you know, one more shot for pole, and he sort of outbraked himself at turn four, which I think was a deliberate move by Martin. He knew Bezzecchi and the other KTMs were sort of lingering around back there, and he didn't want to give anybody a tow that he didn't have to. But Ortel went to pole, then Martin went to pole, and then Binder went to second, but he couldn't quite nip Martin. And then you had Martin and Binder and Sasaki were all in major traffic, and Martin played the draft and the traffic to the absolute best. He wound up on pole, and then Bezzecchi was a very distant 15th in a very intriguing and exciting Moto3 session. So basically, as the qualifying wound down, Martin was on pole. Binder nipped Sasaki to go to second place. Sasaki, of course, was third. Kornfeld, Rodrigo, Ortel, Aberino, Ramirez, Foggia, and Kennett figured out the top 10. And Martin's championship rival, Bezzecchi, was down in 15th. So that was qualifying. Anything you want to add to qualifying, Derek?
No, I mean, that pretty much sums it up. I feel like this is a regular occurrence on my end, but a big shout out to Darren Binder. He's fucking crushing it now. They found whatever, and it's really refreshing to see him in the form he was in at the end of last year.
Mm-hmm. Yep, he was definitely going good there. So if we get into the Moto3 race, we had probably one of the most exciting races. We've always talked in the past about the different MotoGP races. Hey, you show your friends this race to get them hooked on racing and whatnot. If you need another supporting race for this, throw this Moto3 race into the list of races that was there. So Martin was the first man out. He had the lead. He got a great hole shot, but then he just got swamped by the slipstream of everybody going into turn one at the start. That allowed Rodrigo to kind of go to the front briefly, but then Martin kind of found his form a little bit through the first and second turns, and he wound up looked like he was going to be out front, and then he seemed like he would want to try to break away again. The Martin tactic of late has been, hey, I'm fast. I know I'm fast. I carry a lot of corner speed. If nobody's in front of me, I can ride my lines on the track the way I want, carry the corner speed that I want, and you guys can't keep up with me. So I'm going to try that tactic here. And he did. However, it didn't work. It's too fast and too flowy, and the KTMs definitely just chased him all back down again. So by the time we got through like the first few laps, Martin was starting to sort of go backwards a little bit, and Bezzecchi, who had started 15th, was starting to use the draft to kind of work his way back up a little bit. Darren Binder, who made his presence felt, he was picking up kind of chasing on Martin and was using his lines and kind of was rolling with him, and he kind of went to the front. Then you had Ramirez at the front. You had Foggia at the front. Everybody was changing every few turns, few feet. It was just amazing what was going on. Martin sort of got pushed back down the list. He was fading a little bit anyway, and he kind of rolled all the way down the line. There were so many people with so many places, and they were all changing and going different places. You didn't know where to look. You didn't know who to watch. It was incredible. Some of the overhead views from the helicopter were fantastic. I mean, there was, you know, 14, 15, 16 motorcycles within some big gaggle that was all there. But then the bad racing luck struck yet again, and this time it struck Bezzecchi. Now, Bezzecchi finally got past Martin and looked like he was going to the front, but what happened was that Rodrigo's bike, he was going into, I think they were going down after the hay shed, so I think that's turn 10. He lost the front end, and it took out Bezzecchi. So Bezzecchi is now going to get no points. He's out of the race. And somehow this seemed to like a wake-up call for Martin or something, because, hey, I need to get back to the front because I've got this ability now to really put a good set of points back on the table on my rival, who's now not in the race anymore. So he tried to start to claw his way back up there as well. But Gigi Antonio, who had started way back, he was like 17th on the grid, he came through the pack and was running towards the front. And by the end, the fighting was getting so crazy that we lost De La Porta, Ramirez, and then Masia. They all wind up having DNFs as well. With about 10 to go, Sasaki took a turn at the front. Arbolino was at the front. Arenas was there at the front for a little bit, then back. Martin started to use a draft and started to work his way through. He sort of came back through. We had a 17-rider lead pack. That was 17 bikes, all had an absolute shot to win with this going into it. So as we boiled down to the last lap, Martin was out front, and again, he tried to break away. Again, he thought he had pace. He thought he had the corner speed. He thought if he was out front, he'd be able to actually run his lines and get away. He tried, and he notched it up and tried to break. He couldn't. Everybody else just had a sniff and knew that they were all close and they had chances to win. So everybody else just ramped it up with him and went with it. So as it came down, there was a great Twitter video out there. David Emmett had tweeted it. It shows the beginning of the last lap from the helicopter. And as they come out of the last turn and down the main straightaway, in one shot, there's 14 motorcycles spread out, 5-6 wide down the front straightaway, trying to figure out how it was going to late break into the first turn. It was one of those moments where I put the notebook down, put the pen down, and just kind of went and held my breath, because you didn't know what was going to happen in that first turn. You're just expecting chaos, and just I could just see carbon fiber pieces just going every which way. But somehow magically, everybody made it through that final lap. Martin, thinking about being out front and how every time he was out front, he got drafted back by, decided to kind of cool it a little bit and played his strategy wrong and didn't get back to the front when he wanted to, because he made a couple little unforced errors because he got a little too far back there. But basically, Arenas had played the perfect last lap, and Arenas was able to actually roll up and play it all correctly to actually win the race. And then everybody sort of blew across the line at one point, and you didn't know where anybody was or anybody finished, other than you knew Arenas had won, but you didn't know where everybody else was in the list. But as it broke down, there was Arenas winning, Fabio Di Antonio finished second. Vietti was on for third. That was, I think, he wasn't wild carding, but that was his first or second race on the bike. He wound up
second race.
Yeah. Thank you. And he wound up getting third. Suzuki was fourth. Martin had to settle for fifth. Suzuki did just barely nip Martin at the line. Canet was then sixth. Noradin was seventh. Bastianini was eighth. Kornfeld was ninth. Sasaki was 10th. And as you go down the list, poor Darren Binder winds up in 12th after that shuffle. But if you look at the difference in gaps, it is 1 second covering the first 14 bikes, which is absolutely phenomenal. And that's the craziness that was the Moto 3 race.
Yeah, I mean, it was, you know, it's obviously, words don't do it justice. Like, it's one of those things you have to go watch. That last lap was incredible, going down the straight with, like you said, 14 riders abreast. They're just, you know, there's no room for any of them to make the turn, and they all get through it. And that last lap was pretty clean. But yeah, there's some carnage. There was some pretty hefty crashes. Seems like everyone's relatively all right. But yeah, fantastic race. Fantastic racing.
It was definitely the Moto 3 race of the year. I don't think anything else is going to beat that race. It was absolutely fantastic. Really, that little bit there is definitely does no justice to the actual race that was there. Definitely, if you haven't seen it, go watch it. It's worth the time to go find it, watch it again if you've watched it already, because it is an absolutely fantastic race. But what does that do for the championship? With Bezzecchi going down, that gave Martin the opportunity, to open up a very huge lead in his points gaps. But by finishing fifth, he only comes out of there with a 12-point lead going into Malaysia. So we go to Malaysia now. Again, should be another good track for the KTMs. And with Martin having a 12-point lead, he just kind of needs to keep Bezzecchi in sight right now. As long as he keeps him in sight, which he should be able to do, Martin should come home as the victor. But as crazy and as wild as this season has become, you have to think that DJ Antonio, 20 points back in third from Martin, thinks that maybe he might have a chance if he wins out in the next two races, because who knows, bad luck has befallen both Martin and Bezzecchi during the year, and there's nothing to say that these two won't get some red mist and knock each other off. So it's all to play for here in the final couple of races.
Yes, go watch the race if you haven't seen it. I mean, it's incredible. Yeah, no one wants to win this Moto 3 championship. Everyone's just crashing out. But it makes for spectacular drama. There's a lot of yelling at the TV that happens. one of the best races I've seen in a while. Like classic Moto 3 racing. And that's what you want to see, especially at a track like Phillip Island. So, it was fantastic.
Every race should be at Phillip Island. We should just have a whole championship that's just nothing but Phillip Island races, to be honest.
That'd be cool.
I'm all for it.
Maybe do it when it's not like super cold.
Yeah. We could have like a winter championship series that was just nothing but racing at Phillip Island. I could do that.
I think that'd be better. It's just like it like holds everyone over till the next season. You know?
Yeah, that would be true. Okay, Moto 2. After Japan, we had Benyaya with a 35-point lead over Miguel Oliveira. It is definitely between these two guys. And if things fell the right way, Benyaya could have been crowned champion in Australia. So it was a slim possibility. Mathematically, it was going to be tough, but it was going to be possible. But before we race, we have to qualify. And again, we actually had a really interesting Moto 2 qualifying session. I was surprised. Usually it's always kind of processional, and really only the last 10 minutes are worth anything. But Binder had a big crash at turn 8 earlier in the day, so he had to have his bike rebuilt to get out and go in there. Quartararo came out quick, and then, as is the norm, Pacini kind of went faster than anybody to become the quickest that was there. Marquez and Mir were looking very quick as each of those tried to get to the front. And then Marquez went down at turn 9, which is coming over the top of Lukey Heights, heading down to turn. He laid there for a second looking quite battered, and then kind of got himself up. And it was only when we got to see a replay that we realized that O'Donnell was also involved in the crash. And basically what happened was O'Donnell came over the top and sort of got the bike out of shape or lost the front end a little bit there, and he had to close the throttle. And unfortunately, Marquez was coming over the hill with the throttle wide open, and he couldn't avoid him, and Marquez clipped the back of Ordinell's motorcycle and went over the high side and pretty much clonked his head pretty good. He was definitely sitting out the rest of the session, and so Marquez was going to be fairly far down on the grid when it came to it. At that point, both Oliveira and Bender were very far down the list. They were 16th and 17th in the qualifying. Again, Pessini was at the top for reference. Bagnaia was 14th, which was interesting. Bagnaia did not seem as though he was comfortable on the motorcycle. It seems as though that a flowing racetrack does not suit his style. I'm not sure what it is about that he doesn't get along with, but he seems to be much better when it takes a very quick motion to kind of set the bike up onto the center of the tire and very quick changes of direction. But the flowing idea, kind of riding on the edge of the tire, does not suit Bagnaia. Oliveira was having problems. They could not get the motorcycle started. They had tried several times on the little starter motor there, and they could not get it on the wheel rollers that they have, and they couldn't get to work. And Simon Crafer was saying that that's another slipper clutch problem that was going on. So they actually just sort of push start the bike and bumped it on top. Then we got down to the very end of it or whatever. We had a crazy highlight there, a little dirt track action from Joe Roberts. He had come out of the last turn and had got the bike way over the edge of that outer shark tooth curve that's out there, and he just had it sideways, and I was just thinking, that's like, you know, that's 200 Ks, so man, that's going to be hurts if he actually winds up going over the top. But true dirt tracker style, he just kind of just barely cracked the throttle, straightened it back out, and put it back on again. Pessini had fallen. He was out now, and so it was a question of whether his time was going to stand, and it actually did. Oliveira was down in a lowly 20th, and Bagnaia was in 16th. So it seemed as though that Bagnaia and Oliveira just cannot figure out this racetrack, which shocked me considering that this is where Oliveira had kind of turned it around last year, and he can't seem to make that KTM do what he wants it to do this year. And that's sort of how the Moto2 qualifying went. So as it came down for qualifying, you had Pessini, who was on pole. Schroeder wound up going second. Verhey was third. Agatar, a great ride for him, proving that you can qualify KTM. And then you had Bender, who moved himself way up from his lowly 17th that he had early on. He put another tire on and was able to go fifth. And at some point, you got to stop and wonder, like, why aren't the KTM guys putting Bender's setup on Oliveira's bike just for Oliveira to try? Makes me wonder, you know, how can one rider be so much better on essentially a spec motorcycle? And just, you know, I mean, I get it, you know, these guys are incredibly talented, but something's just not working there for Oliveira, and I just don't know what it is. Quartararo was sixth, Marini was seventh, Lecuona was eighth and looking really good for the race. Marquez's time stood to give him ninth on the grid, and then Rafinha was 10th. And that is how things worked for Moto2 qualifying.
Yeah, and kind of back to your point with the KTM setup, I mean, you know, it just could have to do with, like, you know, Brad wanting to set the bike up in a totally different way. And who knows, maybe Miguel has tried it and he's just, like, way slower with it, or just uncomfortable, you know? And, I mean, it also could just be down to the rider, the track, like, there's so many conditions, but mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with you. It is weird that it's just consistently he's so much further back.
Yeah, it was really odd. It's been odd. The thing that gets me is that they both sort of languished way down the qualifying order at the beginning of the year and the middle of the year, but you got to the final, they call this the final third of the season, and Bender seemed to somehow figure something out just before Aragon, kind of like the Misano time frame. He kind of started to qualify better, kind of got it going. Then he did really good at Aragon. He won the race at Aragon. Then you thought it kind of fell off a little bit in Japan. But yeah, this, I just don't get what's going on with KTM. It's just a little bit awkward, I guess. So like I said, maybe they tried it and he just can't ride the bike set that way, and that's entirely possible. It's all about feel and being comfortable on the motorcycle, and if you're not, you're not going to go fast. So it's just that simple.
For sure.
So let's move into the Moto2 race. So Mazzini was out. Manzi was out. He had a swollen left wrist, so he wasn't able to take on the race, or wasn't able to make the start of the race due to that swollen wrist. So that moved Oliveira from 20th to 19th. So everybody kind of bumped a place on the grid. You had Schroeder's bike that would not start, so he could not get off the line for the warm-up lap there. So he had to have the bike taken to pit lane. They had to then restart the motorcycle in pit lane. He was able to then make the lap, but now he was going to start from the very beginning, or from the very back, I'm sorry. So the race starts. Pacini's sort of out front with that. Basically, he winds up losing the front at turn four and goes down. So Pacini was out, which is kind of becoming the norm. Pacini qualifies well and then crashes. Benyaya was actually up in fifth. Bender was out front for a little bit. He was looking pretty fast. Oliveira kind of was right with Benyaya and got by. Benyaya kind of was at the bottom of the top 10, inside maybe the top 15. And I thought, well, hey, Oliveira maybe has something. He seems to be a little bit like Rossi, and he's always has something for race day. So I thought, okay, this is what's going to happen. Oliveira is going to kind of push to the front and kind of go with the top group. But that did not happen. The top group was Bender, Vierge, Lecuona, and Agatar. And then they start to actually pull away. Bagnaia, he just could not push hard on that motorcycle. He had no confidence in it, whether it was the front or the back, I'm not too sure. I mean, he looked good on his corner entry, but he just could not make the bike come off of the corner and accelerate the way that he wanted it to. It looked as though it was a grip issue, but I'm not sure why it was that way. Then Lecuona went wide at turn two, and he almost took a Vierge with him. They were way, way out into the gray and the dusties out there. So Oliveira at that point, he really needed to step it up. This is his opportunity because, you know, like I said, Bagnaia wasn't going anywhere. And, you know, Oliveira really needed to come on strong, and he didn't. He just kind of languished along right there. So back at the front, you had Fernandez. Yeah, he was riding like a madman. I mean, he was cutting and thrusting and going across. He basically was taking everybody, chopping everybody whenever he felt like it, and was really looking pretty good. Like, you know, hey, this guy might be able to take on and wind up on the podium, if not win the thing. Interestingly, Juan Mir had moved his way all the way to fourth, and he actually started to look like the Juan Mir that we saw in Moto 3 and was starting to ride like the champion that we know that he is. And so I was like, whoa, man, maybe Mir's got a shot at winning this one, because him and Marquez were kind of going to the front together, and they were putting in some really fast laps. Oliveira, Benyaya, and then Quartararo were all together with each other, which made that kind of a very interesting section of the race. Those three sort of battling it all out, because there's the guys who have been the fastest all sort of way back in there. And then you had the commentator curse. Everybody noticed that Remy Gardner was up to sixth on the Tectoir Mistral, and then he crashes out of turn 10. So he got cursed or whatever. Vierge wound up trying to put a little breakaway on, but he was not alone, as Baldassare wound up trying to go with him and was able to. And then Oliveira just couldn't stop, and he could not accelerate. He was having all kinds of trouble, and so was Benyaya. So the middle part of the race, those guys were just having a terrible, terrible time. But Vierge was back out front. Baldassare was now out front. It kind of went back and forth. It was just whoever was drafting each other and whoever wanted to be late on the brakes as we went around. Then we wound up with Baldassare down at turn 10. He was out of shape as he came over the crest there at Lukey Heights, and he just basically just outbraked himself and left it way too late and then went down. Mir was then getting really aggressive because he had wound up getting into second, and we're trying to figure out what was going to happen. And then the race kind of broke out into segments at this point, so there wasn't too much time left in the race. But what it came down to was you looked at it and you go, okay, Bender is going to be fighting Mir for the win. That's one little fight. Then there was a gap, and hey, here's the fight. It's Fernandez versus Vierge for whoever's going to stand on the podium for that. And then you had sort of the other group with Oliveira and Bagnaia that were back there in 12th. And so that's how the race actually finished. Bender wins it on the KTM. KTM looking really good. Again, Bender looking really good. His teammate looking not so good as he winds up coming home in 11th. For Oliveira came home in 11th. Vierge again was on the podium. Mir was second, splitting Bender from Vierge. Mir looking really good on the bike. I think that's probably the best ride I've seen Mir put in on a Moto2 bike this year. So maybe they found something finally, or something's finally clicked for them.
I think it could just be down to the track, you know, just like it's a rider's track.
Yeah, agree.
And I think, yeah, Mir's just been so poor of late, and the fact that something clicked, I think, it, you know, since it is a spec class, everyone's on the same machinery, like it really comes down to the rider, and Phillip Island is one of those places that it seems like the rider can really make a big difference. So I think that's why his talent was actually able to shine through this weekend.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it was good to see. I mean, it was good to see Mir back on the podium again. Then, like I said, Fernandez really kind of deserved a podium. He rode really, really well, but he only wound up fourth. Marini was fifth. Agutter, with one of his better rides, finished in sixth. Marquez kind of faded. I guess the adrenaline wore off. He finished seventh. Raffian was eighth. Schroeder got his way from dead last up to ninth. Quartararo was then 10th. Oliveira was 11th. Bagnaia 12th. And then that's how the top championship contenders ended up. So all of that then caused not that big of a shakeup in the point standings. It's now Francisco Bagnaia, 288 points, with Oliveira, 252 points. So that gives us, instead of a 35-point lead, it gives us a 36-point lead. So Bagnaia now inches ever closer to having a championship over Oliveira.
Yeah, I mean, I think you kind of, you know, nailed the points just with the race. Again, kind of a large, a lot of crashes in Moto2, but racing at the end of it became really good. To have the championship contenders in back was kind of frustrating, but it just adds to the drama, right? So we go into Malaysia with another storyline to follow. But yeah, it was again another really good Phillip Island race.
Yeah, it was probably the least entertaining of all three races at Phillip Island. I mean, let's face it, that Moto3 race is going to be a very tough act to follow, and the Moto2 exactly. guys, you know, but this was an interesting Moto3 race, or sorry, Moto2 race, just because Oliveira and Bagnaia weren't at the front, and Bagnaia wasn't out there running his times and pulling away from everybody. You had some really cool racing. You had people that you haven't seen at the front doing well. And again, like you said, maybe it's just because it's a rider's track that these guys suddenly just magically can turn up and run well and whatnot. So it was, you know, really cool to see Mir up front. I thought he definitely deserved it. I thought Bender deserved the win as well, because he, you know, basically rode a very smooth and controlled race to it. Good to see Vierge get back on the podium as well. He sort of had a middle part of the season that just kind of wasn't very good at all, and I think he'd probably like to forget that. So all in all, it was a good Moto2 race. And with that said, we'll move up to the big boys and move into MotoGP. Of course, we know that Marc Marquez is champion, so there's no reason to look at the points or anything at this point, because it's all wrapped up. Although that second place is an interesting battle that we need to keep our eye on. But first, we must look to qualifying. In qualifying, we didn't really have any surprises as far as the people who were in qualifying one. There really wasn't a big name in there other than maybe Pedrosa. He was the only one that you could look at and say, yeah, he really maybe shouldn't have been in Q1. But the guys went out there, they did their thing, and lo and behold, Alvaro Bautista on the factory Ducati, on Lorenzo's factory Ducati, went out there and set a great time, roughly about 0.2 of a second faster than Paul Espargaro, who put in an absolute blinder lap at the end to take the second spot to allow those two guys to actually move forward and into the second qualifying session. So with the second qualifying session on, it was one of those things where, again, there was this threat of rain was kind of coming. So everybody kind of jumped out there and started to go in and start throwing laps. Marquez was the quick man. Then Iannone, who had been quick the whole weekend up to this point, was second. Then Zarco came on. And then Marquez would go back to the top again. And then Marquez had a good tow from Rins. Rins was looking good on the Suzuki as well at this point. So it was interesting. The only person who used a two-bike strategy was Maverick Viñales. Excuse me. He came in, and he just jumped on his bike and went on his number two bike and went back out again, kind of like a Mark Marquez trick, if you will. That's kind of how that goes down. But Marquez didn't. He just stayed in the pits, calmly had a tire replaced, and then they went back out for their second runs. And then it was basically Marquez back at the top. Zarco was there for a few seconds. Iannone was there, then Viñales, then Rins. And then we were kind of wanting to see how was this going to shake out. And what happened was there were a bunch of rain flags that were being displayed at different corners at different times for only a few seconds. I don't think any of the riders really knew what the track conditions were really like, except for maybe Miller, who goes balls out no matter what's going on. I don't think it matters to him whether there's rain on the track or the possibility of it or not. But Miller wound up kind of flying through, trying to basically upset the apple cart. But in the end, he couldn't do that, but he did give it a try. So it finished off with Marquez taking the number one spot, taking the pole. Viñales on the Yamaha would come home for second. Zarco on another Yamaha was third. So two Yamahas on the front row. When was the last time we saw that? Had to be the beginning of the year somewhere. Iannone was a lowly fourth, which was kind of a disappointment for him, because he had been so fast throughout the entire weekend. The Suzukis were just looking fabulous. I mean, they have probably the best handling chassis right now in MotoGP, and they could just let that bike just hang out on the edge grip, and they just, both him and Rins were incredibly quick the whole time. Rins followed Iannone in fifth. Miller, trying to shake things up, was sixth. Rossi was seventh. Petrucci was ninth. Dovizioso was Petrucci is number nine. He was in eighth position for qualifying because Dovizioso was ninth. Safi Sayrin was 10th. Paul Espargaro was 11th. And then Bautista was 12th. And that was only because Bautista had a big off at turn 10. And he kind of lost it going over Lukey Heights. He got the transition from being on the left to going to the right. And you have to brake at the exact same time as you're doing that. And I think between the braking that he was trying to do with the speed he was carrying over the hill and the transition of his body weight just was too much for the bike to actually be able to handle. It kind of bucked him off and he got off and the bike just kind of careened straight on into the barriers down there at the end of the track. When they brought that one back on the little recovery vehicle, that Ducati looked to be quite badly bent up at the end of it. But that was qualifying.
Yeah, and to go along with that point, you know, Bautista definitely had a rough first 2 days on that factory Ducati. I can imagine, you know, being excited, kind of wanting to really show the potential of the bike. And I guess part of not knowing what the potential of the bike is, you know, it seemed like he was a little eager on it. And thankfully, he came away uninjured in those first 2 days. But he did have a couple big crashes.
Mm-hmm. Yep, it was definitely a pretty nasty looking crash. I mean, anytime the bike stays upright and kind of rides itself gyroscopically and takes off, it's always not going to be good. But it was good that he was trying. I mean, he was kind of looked as though he was making the point that, hey, I said if I had a better bike, I could actually do better. And he was. So maybe his claims that he was making at the Saxon Ring that, hey, I deserve the factory ride or I deserve this or that, might have been founded because he was on arguably one of the better bikes in the paddock, you know, probably the best all-around bike in the paddock, to be quite honest, and he was looking good on it. So maybe it's MotoGP's loss and maybe it's World Superbike's gain. I'm not too sure what's going to happen there, but regardless of it, Bautista was putting in the ride of a lifetime, that is for sure. So with all that said and done, we'll move into MotoGP race. So at the start, Petrucci got the hole shot and was out front, but he overcooked it going into turn two, got out of the seat, and then he ran off at turn two. Then Miller went to the front. So you're like, okay, now things are going to get crazy because, you know, Miller had a great hole shot from sixth to get to the front. And you're thinking, this is going to be classic, 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 classic Phillip Island race. Zarco slid back to eighth. Marquez went to the front. Vinales went backwards from his second starting position to ninth. And then it was Marquez. Dovizioso had a great start to get up there to be following Marquez. And then it was the Zukis behind. So the Miller, Iannone, Zarco, Rossi battle was really, really pretty good at the beginning of the race. Those guys were mixing it up. They were definitely racing hard. And, you know, it was classic Phillip Island draft here, outbreak here. You know, who's got the balls, who doesn't. You know, Miller's probably got the biggest ones of anybody, and he was definitely racing really, really well. But Zarco was kind of the guy who started to lead that pack, and he was using the draft to move his way up towards the very front. And then with 23 laps to go, we get into the big moment of the race. As they're heading down the front straightaway into the first turn, into Doohan Corner, turn one, Dovizioso's out front. Marquez is drafting behind him and moves to his left to set up for the corner in Dovizioso's draft. Was it Miller? I thought it was Dovizioso was out front at that point.
I think Dovi was like further, but I think it was Miller was leading that. It was like Miller, Marquez, and Zarco.
Okay.
And
I'll go with that.
It was
so crazy what went on there. I just assumed that it was Dovizioso out front, Marquez drafting him in second. But if it's Miller, that's fine. It doesn't really matter because it's the result of what happens next that we're going to be talking about. And it's the fact that Zarco now suddenly gets a draft off both motorcycles and then hits Marquez's back wheel entering turn one. Sparks, smoke, and carbon fiber fly as Zarco's bike flips up, flings him off, and then catapults itself down the rest of the track. Somehow, by nothing more than pure luck, Marquez is able to hang on to the motorcycle and continue on. Zarco is basically, by this point, flat on his back with, you know, hands crossed, feet out, and he's sliding, you know, with his feet in the direction of traffic on the grass on the side of the track, just zooming along there. I saw a tweet from Matt Oxley saying that when Zarco bailed off the bike, he bailed off at 280 kilometers an hour, or roughly 173 miles an hour in old money, which was absolutely incredible. And it was a super scary moment in the race. It was that hold your breath for a second because you could almost sense something was going to happen because they were all so tight. And I love Phillip Island, but I always have to hold my breath a little bit at turn one. They're going so fast, and there's so much happening with the draft there that anything could possibly happen. And this is one of those moments that something bad did happen. So what I wanted to go over with everybody is kind of want to take you through sort of Zarco's mindset when he's there. You know, Zarco is feeling the draft off of one bike, and I don't really understand. You know, it's a racing incident this kind of thing will happen, but what I don't really get is how Marquez moved over and didn't really realize that Zarco was actually there. Now, most of the time when a rider's in a draft like that, you'll actually know when somebody is behind you or is close because the air coming over you will tend to pull, and another rider like pulls in behind you, it will take that air that's going over your back and it will straighten out and create a low pressure area on your back, and it'll pull your leathers off your back just that little bit. And you'll feel sort of that kind of rush of air, sort of like your leathers move around a little bit. And Marquez never, if he experienced that, he didn't recognize it, or it wasn't enough for him to know that Zarco was actually over there. I mean, he could have been paying attention to other things and whatnot, because I mean, we're traveling again, you know, 280 kilometers an hour going into one. You're trying to focus, you're trying to find your brake marker, you're in a draft. And when you're in that draft like that, literally you feel like you have no brakes. Zarco was going a little bit late on the brakes. Marquez was maybe a little bit early on the brakes. But when Zarco grabbed those brakes and hit him hard, he was, and he, you know, the only way I can describe it to you is feeling like if you were driving your car down the interstate and you had a car that had like a soft brake pedal, you throw the brakes on and the car kind of wants to stop, but it's not actually stopping as hard as you really want it to stop. So that's kind of what's going on with Zarco. Then when he caught the draft off of both bikes, that vacuum was so much bigger that Zarco, well, there was no way he could slow down. I mean, yeah, Zarco is probably braking at absolutely maximum brake pressure, but he can't slow the bike down anymore because the suction, the absence of any air resistance against his motorcycle basically nullifies the brakes to some extent at that point. Yeah, he's braking, but it just doesn't feel like you're going to brake. And then he has no time to react, and because Marquez is coming from the right over. And luckily, they kind of touched. And like I said, it was just lucky that things happened the way that they did, and that, you know, Zarco kind of separated from the bike and went the direction that he went. And it was good that Marquez was able to stay on his bike, because if he didn't stay on the bike, it could have been really, really bad accident that happened there. So, I mean, these are the things that happen when you're playing in the draft and you're playing in close proximity to one another. In fact, Zarco's crash was so vicious that it appeared as though it had broken the entire subframe on Marquez's Honda, which that has to be a heck of a wallop to do that kind of damage and to that motorcycle. But that's the big talking point of the race. Is there anything about that you want to talk about, Derek? Because that it was an incredible moment.
Yeah, I mean, it's a pretty crazy moment. I think Zarco was just, you know, he was just behind Mark, and Zarco seemed to be more in Miller's draft than Mark's draft. So the fact when he moves over, it doesn't give Zarco a lot of space. It makes sense that he at least to me, that he couldn't see him or couldn't feel him at all, or you know, didn't really realize he was there. But yeah, at the end of the day, like, it's crazy to watch. Super happy both riders are okay, because that, like you said, 180 miles an hour, like, that could have gone really wrong. So just the fact that they both walked away from it and understood, like, both of them understood it was a racing incident, like, for as kind of terrifying and fantastic goal as that was, just the fact that everyone has such a cool head and everyone's okay, like, that's all that matters.
Yep. You know, Marquez said in his interview, I think with Simon, you know, he said at first, he says, I came back, I was angry, but then I look at the video and I realize it is nothing more than a racing incident, and that is all that it is. And these things happen, and the most important thing is that both Zarco and myself are okay. And then Mark even went over to see if Zarco was actually okay, which is, you know, what you need to do in those situations. These are the people that you travel around the world with, and you need to pay them some respect. And it was good to see that was actually done. But, you know, scary, scary, scary moment. But let us move on from the scary moment and continue on down the road. So now after that crash, it's Dovizioso leading Vinales, leading Iannone. Rossi is there. Miller is there. And at one point, it was Vinales and Rossi 1-2. And when was the last time we've had Yamaha's 1-2 in a race? I mean, it's been...
I cannot think of a time that ever happened. Yeah. That's basically what it feels like, you know?
Yeah. It was a very long time ago. Yeah. Yeah. So it was there for a little bit. Then Vinales basically turned into the Vinales of old. He started laying down fast lap after fast lap after fast lap. Kind of started to remind you of some guy, named Jorge Lorenzo, doing a metronomic smackdown of everybody with that Yamaha. And it was good to see. I mean, I was happy to see Vinales out front. I was happy to see him running that kind of pace. And he was definitely trying to clear off, and it looked as though he was going to be successful at it. Pedrosa, having a terrible weekend, fell down at turn 14, and he really has no explanation for why he fell. He just did. Iannone then decides to pick up the mantle of the Marc Marquez mode and just go into full-on racer red mist as he went by Rossi to take second and was looking to see if he could get anywhere near Vinales. Then he would kind of mess up. He'd go backwards a little bit, and he'd be fifth. And then, you know, Rossi wound up being faded. Then sort of Iannone kind of worked his way back up. And then here comes Bautista and Dovizioso. So they were all right there in the mix. And it was interesting to see Bautista. He at one point was actually ahead of Dovizioso. And that was a really entertaining battle. I think at one point, Dovizioso was thinking, hey, this guy who just now jumped on a 2018 Ducati is not going to beat me. So they kind of went back and forth there. And their little battle between the teammates kind of let Iannone slip away. So Vinales was out front. And then here comes Iannone. Again, Iannone riding a spectacular race. Tried to catch Vinales, but couldn't do it and wound up being second. So Vinales wins it going away. He beat Iannone by a second and a half. Dovizioso put Bautista behind him and finished third on the podium. Bautista fell off by about 3 seconds behind him. Who knows if Ducati just told him, hey, bring it home because we're looking for the team championship on there. And we don't know if he got a dash signal or I didn't see anything on his board. I think he might have just ran out of tire.
Yeah, he made a couple mistakes in the second to last lap, and I think it just pushed him back too far. And by then, he was just like, you know, I all racers want to finish the race.
Oh,
so
sure.
I think he understood what was going on. And a fourth place on a factory bike, he was more than happy to take that, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yep, it was one of those things where you're right. He made a few mistakes. I think maybe, you know, that was the hottest it had been all weekend because the other days were cloudy, spotty with rain, and this was a beautiful, bright, sunshiny day. Air temperature was a little bit low, but track temperature was into the 100 degrees Fahrenheit by the MotoGP race. And Dovizioso has always said that you need to manage your tire over the length of the distance this year. It's very much a tire management kind of a race. And if you've never ridden that motorcycle, you don't know how long that tire is going to last. So it might have been one of those things where he was starting to lose some rear grip, which would cause a little bit more pressure on the front end. And then if you had a little more pressure on the front end, then you want to use the back end to kind of steer it a little bit. So, you know, all in all, great result for Bautista to be there in fourth. Rins rode into fifth, about a second behind. Rossi made sixth place his. Miller then came home in seventh. Franco Morbidelli, believe it or not, is the first Honda to finish in eighth. Aleix Espargaró having a great ride on the Aprilia. Sorry, Aprilia, I didn't mention you earlier. But they looked very well at ninth. Again, you know, helped by a little bit with a couple guys going out up front, but still, the Aprilia looked good, looked racy. It was a hodgepodge Frankenstein motorcycle. It was some 2019 parts mixed in with some 2017 parts with a 2018 motor. So they were definitely trying different things to try to make the motorcycle better. And it looks like maybe they have found something. Bradley Smith came home then in 10th. So that is how it all finished. So the points championship. Obviously, Marc Marquez is your champion. He's got 296 points. Dovizioso has now got a 15-point gap on Rossi, so he takes a little bit of comfort going into the final two races of the year. I don't think Rossi's going to actually beat Dovizioso. I think that's his spot. Rossi will be third. Look for Vinales, if he can continue this form, to hopefully chase Rossi down and maybe nip Rossi. That's where the fight probably is. It's, again, it's a 15-point gap there, so it seems to be like a theme. And then there's Crutchlow, Petrucci, Zarco, Iannone, Lorenzo, and Rins are your top 10 in points. And that is how things went on the island. What do we think about the racing, Derek? Good, bad, it's typical Phillip Island?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say the MotoGP race in... like, obviously it was exciting, but it was nice to see Yamaha win. But nothing's going to live up to last year. Last year was something else. But, I mean, it was still good racing.
It was something that was like 490 days since Yamaha's last win. Something close to that, I think.
Yeah, very, very long time.
Which is a very, very long time. Again, you know, here's one of those things where is it the fact that as a racetrack, Phillip Island flatters those motorcycles that aren't very good, you know, or don't use their tires very well, because there's really not a lot of continuous acceleration points, right? You have hard braking at turn four, right? And then you accelerate back up to sort of your top speed, if you will. Then you work your way to turn 10, where you brake very hard, and then you accelerate back out again. And it seems as though that style of track with the very flowy section sort of benefits the Yamaha. We kind of saw that a little bit in Thailand when Yamaha kind of had their resurgence. That third sector is a very flowy kind of a sector, and the Yamahas were doing really, really well there. I hope Yamaha has figured something out. I'm hoping that they've got it, some idea that this is where they're going to go down and how they're going to progress with their development in an effort to try to make that bike competitive from the word go next year. So hopeful that they're getting on top of the situation. And I think part of it is their electronics package, although Vinales did say that they've kind of did what I want it to do to the bike to make it comfortable for me. Now, what that is, I have no idea. But again, it's all about feel. And if you're comfortable on a motorcycle, you're willing to push it to the limit. And when you can push to the limit, you're going to go fast. So I'm hoping that this is the corner turned, no pun intended, for Yamaha.
Yeah, for sure. So, and then in, today's Monday, so by Friday, we'll be back in Malaysia.
Yes.
There's going to be some rain. There's going to be some excitement. You know, the Malaysian crowd always brings a large crowd, and with Hafi Siren and MotoGP, place is going to be bonkers.
Yeah. I think it's going to be fascinating to see, again, with Siren there, it's going to be bonkers. And, you know, this is a track where we want to focus on what's going to happen. I mean, I think Marquez is going to want to atone for his sins, if you will. Again, Marquez wins the race in Motegi, wins the championship in Motegi, and then goes to Phillip Island and does not score any points. That's, Honda wants the triple crown. They want the rider's title. They want the team's title and the manufacturer's title, and they need it. They lost some ground and all of that, and they're going to need Marquez to be at his best the next two races for them to maintain that. And they're also going to need Crutchlow, but I don't think Crutchlow is going to make it back in. So a lot of that pressure is going to fall on Marquez. So that's going to be interesting to watch and see how that pans out over the next two races. But again, Phillip Island gave us great racing, and that's what we really expect to see. So as we wrap it all up here, the Moto3 guys are definitely the championship to watch. It is between Martin and Bezzecchi. It is a 12-point gap, which is nothing going into these final two races. And Malaysia should be a racetrack that benefits KTM. They have the horsepower down the two long straightaways, although Martin is amazingly rapid with corner speed. Then we got the Moto2 race to look forward to from Sepang. Hopefully maybe Oliveira will finally get something going on. Maybe Binder will run the table out. Maybe he will run Australia, Malaysia, and Valencia for wins, which would be interesting for KTM, be good for them. But that title is a 36-point lead, so there is some good math that's going to happen there, because you only have 50 points. So basically Bagnaia can win if something bad happens to Oliveira. We'll hope that that doesn't happen, because I want to see that championship go down to the very end in Valencia as well. So with all that done, do you have anything else you'd like to add before we sign off, Derek?
No, that's about it. Basically, like I said, we are going to Malaysia next week. World Superbike is done. BSB is done. Moto America is done. So these last two races are all we have left until a very long winter.
Yes. So folks, if you want to get in contact with us, give us some feedback, the good, the bad, the ugly. We like it all. We take it all in stride. We always want to be better. You can do that by emailing us at motopod@motopodcast.com. That's a big thank you again to Lynn and Andy for their World Superbike review. Thank you, Derek, for coming on and talking this crazy Phillip Island MotoGP race with me. And until the next race from Sepang, goodbye, everybody.